Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of Lost Origins, your number one radio show for all things ancient mystery, alternative historical theory, and lost civilizations. Make sure that you guys check us out on our website at lost-origins.com and make sure that you sign up for that free newsletter. We are in the process of rolling out some contests with some rewards of autographed books from some of the guests that we've brought onto the show, and only people that have subscribed to that newsletter are going to be eligible to win. So head over to the website, hit subscribe, never miss an episode or an article from your friends here at Lost Origins. You guys can also connect with us on social media. We are on almost every single platform. We're very active on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. This week's episode of Lost Origins is brought to you by Worldviews Media. Worldviews has two incredible events coming up later this month with none other than Robert Bouval himself. On May 27th, Bouval will be speaking at the Sedona Creative Life Center. Doors open at 6 p.m. for that event. And then from May 28th to May 30th, Bouval and Worldviews Media will be facilitating day trips throughout the ancient Southwest. So you'll be able to check out the Verde Valley ruins, museums, petroglyphs, and much more with Robert Bouval, with him explaining to you the importance of these artifacts and these sites. So you do not want to miss this event. Head over to worldviewsmedia.com/seminars. Views is spelled V-I-E-W-Z. And make sure that you snag up your tickets early. This week's episode of Lost Origins is also brought to you by our good friends over at Inner Traditions and Baron Company. Inner Traditions has been publishing books on esoteric philosophy, New Age spirituality, and alternative health for well over 40 years. So head over to their website at innertraditions.com. You guys can learn more about their books, their authors. You can sign up for coupons, catalogs, and special offers. We absolutely have enjoyed working with Inner Traditions and Baron Company. Many of our guests published through them. So everything we've ever read here at Lost Origins from Inner Traditions and Baron Company, we have been just huge fans of. We highly recommend them. Go pick up a book. You will not be disappointed. So this week's show of Lost Origins, we are able to welcome back our good friend and author and researcher, Carl Lehrberger. Carl's recent book, Secrets of Ancient America, has created an incredible buzz surrounding the new history of America. His work follows his journeys through America in search of old world contact that has been ignored by mainstream science. So today we're going to be talking about more of the ancient sites that we didn't really have time to cover in our last conversation, including Mojave North, many similarities between different symbols of the Old World and the New World, and the Anubis Cave in Oklahoma, right after the break. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are back. I'm your host, Andrew, and if you're just tuning in, today we are joined by our very good friend, Carl Lehrberger. This is Carl's second time coming on the show, and we had such an intriguing conversation during our last sit-down that we knew we had to bring him back. Carl is the author of Secrets of Ancient America, a book that we highly recommend here at Lost Origins. His book chronicles over 25 years of field work regarding his journeys to uncover evidence of old world contact in the new world. So we are very excited to dig into the specifics of these sites today, what they mean for the new history of America. And so with that, backed by popular demand, it is my pleasure to introduce Carl Lehrberger for this week's episode of Lost Origins. Carl, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Andrew, and it's wonderful to be back and speaking with you and Ancient Origins Radio listeners.
Yeah, the pleasure is all ours. We thoroughly enjoyed the conversation last time. We know that our listeners thought it was incredibly intriguing. And I know we left everybody wanting more, right? We got into some pretty broad topics, important topics, mind you. But the last time we had talked, we had discussed in detail the Celts, their influence in New England, and how they had started to travel into the Americas, but we ran out of time. So what I want to do today, Carl, is I want to kind of journey west with you, and I want to talk about some of these sites in a more specific manner. So I think what I'd like to do first is, in one of your chapters of your book, you had referenced the Anubis Caves in Oklahoma. Walk us through this site, the evidence that you found there, and the importance that that evidence holds for the new history of America.
Well, it's a big story, and I'd like to begin the story by talking about the auspicious timing of this interview, Andrew.
Sure.
Which is May 7th, and it's very near the traditional May Day. Here in the modern world, we think of May Day as a labor celebration that takes place May 1st. But the roots of May Day go back thousands of years to the cross-quarter day in the Celtic culture known as Beltane or Beltana, the celebration of Bel, the sun god, the Celtic sun god. And what is so interesting and actually new information for most archaeologists and people interested in astronomy and archaeoastronomy is that while the equinox is very well documented in rock art in alignments, and you often see a light dagger will strike the center of a spiral or a circle on equinox that represents a calendrical accounting for that day. But there are also, what we call heliolithic animations or moving light shadow shows on petroglyphs that celebrate the equinox. Hmm. But what we have learned is that especially old world cultures like the Celts also celebrated the cross-quarter days. These are the 4 days of the year that are equally distanced between the equinox and the solstices. Mm-hmm. So as an example, Beltana, or the celebration of Bel, celebrated in May, is equal distance between the spring equinox and the summer solstice. So we have 4 cross-quarter days, and the 2 cross-quarter days of Beltana in May and Lunasa, which also celebrates a sun god, the god Lu, in August, are the sun is in the exact same position, which is contrasted with the 2 what I refer to in my book as the feminine deities that are celebrated on cross-quarter day in November, in what has come to be known as Halloween, but in Celtic is Samhain, and the celebration of the goddess Bridget in the spring. Hmm. Now, it's important to talk about cross-quarter days because they really distinguish the archaeoastronomy of the old world peoples and nearly all North American, Native American archaeoastronomy.
Okay.
So we're celebrating May Day, and as we move west with the Celts from their stronghold in New England several thousand years ago, they came across the Atlantic, mostly searching for minerals, but also furs and other aspects of trade, and expanding out from their stronghold in New England at sites including America's Stonehenge outside of Salem, New Hampshire. They followed the rivers to the Mississippi, and as they traveled, they marked their way with gnomes that established the distances that they were traveling, and some of these are still can be found. But once at the Mississippi, they made their way to the Arkansas River and heading west toward the Rocky Mountains, presumably, you know, looking for a pathway through the mountains. They made their way into several of the major tributaries of the Arkansas River in Colorado and in Oklahoma, including the Cimarron and the Purgatory.
Hmm.
And we know this because of the outstanding examples of Celtic ogham, that is the writing system
right.
that the Celts used, that are found in this area. In fact, Bill McGlone, the author of Ancient American Inscriptions, refers to this area of southeastern Colorado and parts of Kansas and Oklahoma as the Ogham Corridor, because there was such a predominance of Celtic writing found in this area. And by predominant, I'm talking about perhaps dozens of sites compared to the many, many thousands, if not tens of thousands, of Native American petroglyph sites in
right.
the same area. Nevertheless, these few sites document that the Celts were here. And I'd like to briefly mention two sites that are described at length in the book. The first site is called the Sun Temple, and I bring it up because, unlike the Anubis Cave, which I'm going to talk about, which is dedicated to the equinox,
mm-hmm.
The Sun Temple is a monument to the cross quarter day, and the actual solar alignment that takes place occurs as the sun rises on Beltane, on and it also occurs at marking the August cross quarter day. So we know that the Celts celebrated Beltane. And in fact, at this site, some of the ancient writing describes the celebrations in Celtic that is written on the cave walls there. So not too far near the a greater distance than the Sun Temple in southern Colorado is the Anubis Cave. This is in the Oklahoma Panhandle,
mm-hmm.
and the name itself, Anubis, comes from the Egyptian jackal god or canine god known as Anubis or the Lord of Night,
mm-hmm.
and in Egyptian mythology, he's often represented as a dog or an Anubis. Now, this is not just any dog or howling wolf or coyote that is very common in Native American representations. The specific Anubis from the Egyptian culture has a staff that extends out of its back and is also often depicted with a white crown, that is the white crown of Egypt. And it was Gloria Farley that in the 1980s was led to the site, 1980s or 1970s, was led to the site by a rancher and immediately saw the Anubis or the dog glyph and named the site Anubis Caves. This is a site in the Oklahoma Panhandle that has five caves that have petroglyphs and Celtic writing. And what makes it so phenomenal in the world of archaeoastronomy is that it's just not one alignment or even two alignments, but it's multiple alignments that take place as the sun goes down on the day, or I should say, the night of the equinox.
Okay.
And the details of this site are extraordinary, and one would want to refer to the book Secrets of Ancient America or refer to a site done by Keen Scott Monahan, the archaeoastronomy.com, where videos of the alignments can be seen,
mm-hmm.
and they're quite spectacular. But since we don't have that available, I will just say that the ancients presented at Anubis Caves a description of these alignments in terms of equal day, equal night will occur, and they integrate the writing in Celtic Ogham with the actual light shadow play that takes place on the petroglyphs at this specific time of year. That is a Heliolithic animation. And the most spectacular animation at Anubis Caves of several is that as the sun goes down, the Jekyll god Anubis stands in light as a petroglyph on this cave wall. And as the sun sets on the horizon, the shadow begins to cover the sun god. And just as the sun begins to dip on the horizon, the sun god goes in complete shadow, while the Anubis, the lord of night, or the god of death, which carries the soul or the sun at this time of darkness, is in light. And we have this spectacular image of the sun god, who's been identified as Mithras, the a variation of the Celtic sun god from India, Mitra, is standing in shadow. So we have this great depiction of the cosmology of the ancients in this cave wall that takes place only on equinox. And just as the previous description of the sun temple alignment that takes place at Beltana, these archaeoastronomical alignments are specifically tied to these very sacred and special days of the ancients. And what we are celebrating at Anubis Cave is, you could almost say, the death of the sun god.
Wow.
As the sun sets and the sun god dies, goes into shadow, and we start a cycle of the night being ruled by Anubis. So it's quite spectacular. And I would say, fortunately, it's on private property. It has been relatively protected. Unfortunately, some kids did get in there, and there's some graffiti. Probably most tragically, an earlier researcher used plastic to get molds of some of the glyphs, and they didn't set properly. So when the molds were pulled out, some of the patina or the rock surface of these glyphs came out. So there is damage, but I would say that relative to other sites, that the Anubis Cave is perhaps the best documentation of the farthest expansion west in the United States of the of the Celts. And in addition to that, probably the most descriptive in terms of describing a religion of the Celts relating to the sun god or relating to Mithra and the Mithras religion. And I spend quite a bit of time in the book talking about how the sun god that's shown at Anubis Cave was likely the deity of Mithras. And there's a lot of evidence to suggest that. And the story is quite profound because what we find in Oklahoma is perhaps more evidence and representations of how the ancients celebrated Mithras than you find anywhere in Europe today, because these European sites and Mithraeums have been so destroyed by some of the Romans and mostly the church.
Sure.
So it's an incredible story that we end up with the Celts here in Oklahoma, Colorado. There isn't a lot of evidence that they made it over the Rocky Mountains. We do find some glyphs that are in the front range of the Rocky Mountains that are in Ogham. And one of these sites documented in the book has been destroyed. Another, the glyph near the town of Lyons, has been lost. So it's harder to document. We also find some Celtic writing in the Rocky Mountains in Canada. But for all practical purposes, I don't think that the expansion of the Celts across the Atlantic, coming into New England, really establishing their base there, and then expanding out westward, don't think they made it much past the Rocky Mountains.
Sure. And so, like, what do we know roughly around what time the Celts were this far west? I mean, year-wise?
Well, we don't have a good date, okay. And we don't have an authentic date. So we have some ranges, and we have some methods of guessing when the dates are. I guess the short story is that we estimate these are around 1,800 to 2,000 years in age, and part of the part of that is based on the actual iconography in the Anubis caves. Mm-hmm. For example, in Europe, you see the Mithras religion eventually celebrating the death of the bull. And the imagery in Europe shows Mithras actually slaying the bull. Okay, this is a later day version of the story of the sun god.
Sure.
We don't see that at Anubis Cave, so we can assume that it's earlier than this than this particular time.
Okay.
We also have some opportunities to date the work by the constellations that were left in Cave 1 that really provide an interpretation of a celebration of a specific event that took place around 400 AD.
Wow.
So there's a range in there between 1500 and perhaps 2000 years. But until we would find any artifact, or until there's a way to significantly date the patina in the actual rock art, it's going to be elusive. There was some carbon dating done by a scientific team, and the dates were pretty much consistent with what I provided. You know, around the time of Christ and 200 AD. But these are controversial testing methods and haven't been universally accepted by the scientific community.
Sure.
I will say that the pioneers that really studied this site, Bill McGlone and Philip Leonard, met nothing but resistance from the archaeological community. And it wasn't just a friendly archaeological debate. This was heated, and it took personal attacks on Bill. And one of the attacks claimed that Bill and Phil Leonard actually went in there and carved those petroglyphs themselves and carved the writing because nobody else could have done it, and it was impossible for the Celts to be here. This was actually presented. Rebut the idea that the Celts were here and that somehow McGlone and Leonard had faked it. Well, it turned out that a cowboy in the late 1800s named Tom Ujima had put his name and carved it at Anubis Caves over the Celtic rock art. And it proved beyond any doubt that cowboy in 1880 or 1890, whatever the date was, and did provide a date, came after the writing, and that McGlone and Leonard, who weren't even born, couldn't have possibly have done it.
Sure.
So dating is controversial until we would either get a group of scientists with sophisticated dating equipment of the rock art and patina, or miraculously we're able to recover any hidden artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to remain elusive.
Right. Well, you say dating is controversial. It seems that with anything archaeological, almost damn near everything is controversial. I mean, the chokehold of modern uniformitarianism is just It's shocking. And, you know, anything that upsets the apple cart and challenges what we've committed to for the last, you know, several hundred years of academia, well, that's something that we're not going to talk about. And that's a quick ticket to become blackballed, like you had mentioned. So, but thank you for walking us through the Anubis Caves. They sound fascinating. And in your book, it was very easy to kind of not only picture them because of how well you put the book together, but then also the images that you provide the reader really reinforce everything. It's really fascinating to actually see those carvings and those glyphs. It's just fascinating.
Well, thank you. And I think the important point that I would like to leave with the audience is that I note that there are perhaps a half a dozen smoking gun examples that prove beyond any doubt that the Celts were in America. And one of these is the Anubis Caves. And the corroboration comes with the actual Celtic writing that can be read that's talking about an alignment that's going to take place with the petroglyph. Mm-hmm. And we see that at the time of year noted, in the case of Crack Cave, is the day of Bel. And it's the same as with Anubis Cave, we have this precise archaeoastronomical alignment on a petroglyph as predicted in the rock art. Not once, not twice, but multiple times. So to me, there's no question that the Celts were here and they left their mark.
Right.
And what's amazing is that this position is not considered credible enough for archaeologists to go out and test the thesis. That's how incredible it is.
Right.
But it's a great segue to talk about the other oceanic travelers that made it to the New World.
And that's a good point. You do raise some points in the book that talk about transoceanic travel and then also many similarities between symbols found from both sides of the world. We do have to take a quick break, but when we come back, Carl, I want to dig into those examples. So I'm your host, Andrew, and we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more from Carl Lohrberger. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to this week's episode of Lost Origins. If you're just tuning in, this week we are joined by our friend Carl Lohrberger. This is his second appearance on our show. And today we are talking about very specific examples and sites strewn across North America that are indicative of old world contact in the New World before Christopher Columbus. He is the author of Secrets of Ancient America. And in that book, he details droves of sites. We've been able to talk a little bit about the Anubis Caves today in Oklahoma. And right before the break, we had talked about some transoceanic travel from hundreds and thousands of years ago. And Carl, we talked a little bit about how there are many similarities with regards to symbols found on both sides of the world. You do an amazing job in the book of painting that picture and explaining those symbols. Could you speak to a few of those for us and our listeners?
You bet. And I just would like to take this moment to say that, you know, whatever I wrote about or discovered, you know, it's a team collaborative effort that we, you know, are able to present examples of diffusionism of specific sites that you have to acknowledge the many hundreds of researchers over the last couple of hundred years and the guides and teachers that I was fortunate enough to meet, because no one person is really capable of putting this whole story together.
Right.
It's just such a huge story but as we left off before the break, Andrew, we saw that the Celts coming across the Atlantic, making their way into New England and then following the rivers, you know, into Colorado and Oklahoma, seem to have come up against the Rocky Mountains.
Right.
However, many other groups of people, perhaps before these, I'm going to call them later day Celts of a couple thousand years ago, and came earlier across the Pacific. These were groups from Asia, including Greater Indus Valley in India and what we call Indo-Turkey, Afghanistan and Turkey and that part of the world. And these trans-Pacific voyages was not to any specific point, but really covered South America, Central America, and North America. And one of the really most obvious examples of the trans-Pacific diffusionist contact with the New World is the many symbols that arrived in the New World from Asia. And I'd say that the author that has documented the most of these symbols is Gunnar Thompson, a PhD, who wrote the book American Discovery.
Right.
And he was an anthropologist, archaeologist, and a diffusionist scholar who was pretty much almost banned from academia for his research. But one of the many aspects of Thompson's research dealt with about 20 symbols, Asian symbols, that seemed to show up in Central America and around 200 BC. And these specific symbols, including the yin-yang symbol, including the a serpent motif with the head, and a variety of symbols that are almost exactly the same shown in Asia as they are in America, arrived here at a very specific time but after a couple hundred years, these symbols seem to have stopped and the culture evolved. So locked in time from about 200 BC to 200 AD in an area that was predominantly inhabited by Mayans and related peoples, you see these Asiatic symbols that have showed up. Now, it's not just the Asiatic symbols, but we also find farther north symbols including the swastika, that is a very sacred symbol to some of the Pueblo Indians. Well, of course, the swastika, also referred to as a tetraskelly, which has a cross at the center and then extends out as a swastika does, is a symbol, the ancient symbol from India or Greater Indus Valley.
Right.
So we know that these symbols made it into the New World, most likely coming across the Pacific in certain periods of time when these migrations took place from Indus Valley and Indo-Turkey. These migrations could have been driven by trade and seeking gold and silver that one would have relatively easy to find in California and Nevada.
Right.
It could have been driven by cataclysmic events. For example, ocean rising due to comet disasters. And it also could have been stimulated by political events that took place. Mm-hmm. Whatever the case may be, we have these various periods of migration coming across the Pacific to the New World and landing in Central America, as well as likely, the Bay of San Francisco. And we see the rock art in Nevada and California that perhaps suggest these not only boats coming in across the ocean, and they represent the boats, but also a petroglyph in Nevada of an elephant, perhaps recorded by ancestor to the Native Americans, of these old world peoples coming to the New Worlds with elephants, who's to say. But we do know that they came for gold, they came for silver, and they set up colonies here to do seasonal mining and return back. And when they were here, they needed the labor of the Native Americans. This was probably not a hostile relationship, but a synergistic relationship that took place between the indigenous people and these foreign travelers. So we see the influence coming in by way of symbols, but perhaps the most evidence that we find is in the rock art at a site called Mojave North in eastern California. Sure. Now, unlike the Anubis Cave, which celebrates just one event, the sundown on the equinox, the Mojave North site, which is a very small site, celebrates the two equinoxes, both in the morning and the evening, with archaeoastronomical alignments. They celebrate the winter solstice and the summer solstice, but most particularly, they celebrate the cross-quarter day events, and in a rather spectacular fashion. Now, the Mojave North site is, although it's perhaps the best example of archaeoastronomy in North America because of so many archaeoastronomical alignments throughout the year, it's in a terrible state of condition. I don't name the site because it has been vandalized. It has, we estimate, over 30% of the glyphs have been destroyed through mining operations. Mm-hmm. And every glyph at that site has been damaged in one way or the other. So it's in terrible shape. And furthermore, it is not recognized as a old world site in America, nor is it recognized as an archaeoastronomical wonderland. It is perceived by both the local Native Americans and the government archaeologists as a typical Great Basin petroglyph site, without any acknowledgement of the calendrical alignments that are abundantly clear. Over 13 alignments have been documented at this site that's smaller than an acre. That's not recognized, nor is any possibility that this is an old world site from a trans-Pacific culture recognized. In fact, it is creates a tremendous amount of antagonism between the diffusionist, myself and my colleagues, and the local Native Americans and the local archaeologists who see our work as damaging the site by attracting attention to it, and the Native Americans see the interpretation of this as an old world site as a continuation of whitewashing.
Sure.
So having you know, described some of the concerns and problematic aspects of the site, I want to return to May Day. And as I noted, these old world peoples did celebrate the cross quarter days, and the example provided earlier was the May Day depiction at the Sun Temple in Colorado,
right,
where on the morning of May Day we see an alignment take place that will only happen on that one day. Well, at Mojave North, we also have the May Day alignment that takes place, something that a colleague of mine, Dorian Today, and myself were the first ones to observe in perhaps thousands of years. Wow. And it was a sunrise alignment, and it was quite spectacular. It took place on a petroglyph of an old god, a very simple depiction of the god. And what we see is the light shadow appears as the sun comes up on this panel. It cuts off the triangular head from the rectangular body of this image. And we interpret this to be reference to the spirit of the triangle that is in light on this particular alignment being enlightened, while the rectangular body, the earth, is in shadow. So this is a very interesting depiction and a very old depiction of a alignment that takes place on the cross quarter day. Now, this was a pretty interesting discovery in the sense that there aren't a lot of cross quarter day alignments that are known. But what was remarkable is the same image is used by the ancients for the spring and the fall cross-quarter days, that is, of Bridget's Day and of what we call Halloween or Samhain. Mm-hmm. So the same image was used, but the alignment, instead of creating a light shadow effect with the triangular head, creates a mini similar effect by having the tip of the penis, which was triangular, being in light, and the shaft, rectangular, being in shadow. So on, if I can repeat that, because it's a little complex without the imagery to see it, on the May cross-quarter day celebrating the sun god, we have the alignment in the morning where the triangular head is enlightened and the body is darkened. In the spring cross-quarter day celebrating the goddess, we have the triangular head of the sun god enlightened, while the shaft of the phallus is darkened. A very, you know, analogous representation. Mm-hmm. And in here we're seeing how they celebrated that the to the sun god it's about return to spirit, but with the goddesses and the feminine days of celebration, we're talking about fertility, we're talking about harvest, we're talking about procreation. So at Mojave North, we have this representation of an ancient culture and how they integrated both the feminine aspects and the masculine aspects in a very sophisticated light show that is intended to signal a celebration on that particular day.
Right.
So we have the Celts with the Sun Temple celebration depicted in Colorado, and we have this Trans-Pacific culture depicting the cross-quarter day event in a very different manner, but still celebrating that day.
Right.
This is one aspect of the site, but there are, as I said, there are 13 alignments, and each one has a story. But perhaps one of the most telling aspects of this site that would relate to a Indus Valley culture is that there appears to be an image of a Shiva-like petroglyph. And this is the subject of a equinox sunset alignment that takes place on a 2-inch petroglyph. And it's described at length in the book, but it, for any reader that is interested in the archaeoastronomy aspects of rock art or is interested in the Shiva or proto-Shiva culture that could have made it to America, I urge you to go and look at the photographs and the pictures of this particular alignment on a Shiva image in the rock. Now, in addition to this particular image, there is a very profound and pronounced boulder in the center of the site that my colleague Dorian today named a Shiva Linga. Now, Shiva Lingas are well known throughout the world and particularly Indus Valley. Mm-hmm. It's it's really talking about Shiva's Linga or Shiva's phallus, but it's really more than that because most Shiva Linga iconography integrate the yoni or the which is the feminine principle with the masculine principle in a Shiva Linga. Well, turns out that the so-called Shiva Linga at Mojave North is a unique and very large. It stands over 5 feet and it integrates a basin into it. So you have a phallus and you have a basin, and this is just a very a unique representation of a Shiva Linga, and I think that's why nobody has said, hey, that's a Shiva Linga. But if you look at some of the earlier representations of Shiva Lingas in India, it becomes clear that this is a variation that certainly fits within the guidelines of what a Shiva Linga would be. So this Shiva Linga is in the middle of the site. We have spectacular alignments that take place on the equinox morning, involving a serpent, a light serpent that consumes a petroglyph representing, we believe, an egg to celebrate the equinox. We have the equinox sunset animations that, again, refer to the sun god going into shadow. We have cross-quarter day alignments, both on the masculine cross-quarter days in August and in May, as well as the feminine cross-quarter days in November and in February, as well as a lot of different iconography and, we believe, are inscriptions that have yet to be determined.
Right.
But in addition to the sun symbology that we find at Mojave North, consistent with the ancient ones' preoccupation with stargazing, Mojave North has encoded into it lunar alignments. Now, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say lunar alignments are rare, and I'll qualify it by saying known lunar alignments are rare.
Okay.
Because what I think we discovered at Mojave North is inherent in the site with sophisticated lunar alignments, but heretofore, no archaeologist or archaeoastronomer ever put it together that there was actually an alignment with a meaning that was taking place on that site.
Hmm.
So we have on the cross quarter days, we have on the equinoxes, we even have on the solstices markers. So it's a phenomenal opportunity for historians, anthropologists, archaeologists, archaeoastronomers, Native American people to take a look at the history of North America in a completely different light.
Hmm.
And I predict that as we begin to take the blinders off, Mojave North will become a pivotal site in understanding the trans-Pacific contact complementing the transatlantic contact that took place. Now, I'm really pleased, Andrew, that we had an opportunity today to talk about Anubis Caves in Oklahoma, which we believe are around 1,800 to 2,000 years old.
Right.
And the Mojave North site in Eastern California, which we believe to be at least 3,000, if not 4,000 years old, coming from a trans-Pacific culture.
Wow.
And in studying these two sites, what is striking are their similarities as it relates to the depiction of a sun god, the light shadow archaeoastronomical occurrences that take place on these images on these specific days, and we also have the use of the cross quarter day, not just the equinoxes that's so predominant in the Native American and ancestors to the Native Americans. What's most telling about the two sites is the character of the sun god. You may recall we began talking about the Anubis Cave in Oklahoma, mm-hmm. and the central solar petroglyph being Mithras, a sun god that originated as Mitra in India and then made its way across the Europe and into the Mediterranean as Mithras, and was really celebrated as a main god before he became Mithras to the Celts and the Europeans.
Hmm.
So we find the original Mithras, so to speak, coming from India, heading west.
Right.
But what we find at the Mojave North site is this central sun god from India, call him Mitra or call him Shiva or any other name of the divinity. We find that sun god going across the Pacific Ocean and landing in California. So these two sites, the one in California from a trans-Pacific culture and the one in Colorado from a transatlantic culture, show some similarities in how the ancients depicted their religions and how they related to the cosmology and the calendar keeping. But they also showed the similarities of how they artistically expressed their religion or their culture or their cosmology through inscribing rocks with their art, their petroglyphs, and overlaying on those rock art the astronomy of their calendars, not just relating to, hey, it's the time to celebrate equinox, but equinox, solstice, cross-quarter days, throughout the year.
Right.
So we in America have an incredible opportunity to learn about how East met West here in North America, about learning about how these ancient cultures may have had contact with certain Native American tribes, and how that contact cultural diffusion might have showed up here in the Americas.
Right.
These are going to be cues, but we're never going to get there until we can protect these sites and get non-biased archaeologists and anthropologists and archaeoastronomers in to study them, you know, without a bias for any one position of who was there and who wasn't.
Right.
And to do that, Andrew, as you know, and a theme of your show, we as a culture have to take the blinders off.
Right.
And until we, you know, stop believing that Columbus discovered America and recognize that as far as explorers go, he was the last explorer, not the first.
Right.
And that the interpretation of our history can't be single-minded and presented as an extension of the conquering of the Americas by the church and the conquistadors. That we have a diverse history, a multicultural history, that before the Christians arrived in the New World, we had the Celts, we had the Mediterranean people, including the Phoenicians. We have evidence that the Hebrews were here, that the Romans made it to the Americas, both South America, Central America, and North America. So to tell the experience, the American experience, just through the eyes of a single-minded, you know, Christian ideology, or just with the presumption that the ancestors to the Native Americans only came, you know, across the Bering States and only traveled south without any contact or any interference from old world cultures from both sides of the oceans, we're never going to understand what happened in America, and it's going to continue, I think, perpetuating the lie of who we are as Americans.
Mm-hmm.
We're a multicultural country, and that's what we should be celebrating in our history and in our modern-day celebrations. And a great example of that would be, why are we celebrating Columbus Day?
Right.
When we can be celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day,
right.
Or we can be celebrating all explorers who made it to the Americas.
Well said. I mean, I think that hopefully as time progresses and more of these sites are really showcased with regards to the archaeoastronomical alignments, I mean, those are clearly not accidental or coincidental. So it would be my hope that as more sites are continued to be researched and you know, made public in terms of people like yourself releasing books, hopefully we can finally start to see some of these walls come down and just really analyzing what really happened here. But well said. Carl, we're about out of time. What's next for Carl Lerberger? Do we have another book in the works? Anything you can tell us about?
Well, I would like to direct our audience to www.newhistoryofamerica.com. And my newhistoryofamerica.com website talks about the book and a little about what I'm up to these days. Andrew, my focus is on my professional mission. I like to talk about my passion as being sacred sites and rock art, but my mission being ushering in a renewable era, and I'm very much engaged in developing the renewable economy,
right?
And with a focus on industrial hemp, a new crop with many value-added opportunities. So for the time being, I give lectures. I get into the field as much as possible because it's not just an academic pursuit, but it's really I would call sacred site work that involves personal growth and really trying to learn as much as I can from the ancients, because I think that's what this exercise is about. The ancients left wisdom for us in stone here in America. Mm-hmm. If we are open enough to their message and willing to learn enough about them so that we can read it. The wisdom is left in the stone for not just us. And here's the point, Andrew. It's for our children's children.
Right. Well said. Carl, thank you so much for joining us this week. We really appreciate you coming back on the show. It's always a pleasure to talk to you and pick your brain. I always find our conversations just fascinating. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Andrew, and thank you for your great work.
No, I appreciate that. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this week's episode of Lost Origins. Make sure that you get on innertraditions.com. You can pick up a copy of Carl's book. Make sure you check out his website, newhistoryofamerica.com, to stay up to speed with everything that he's working on. His work is truly fascinating. Make sure that you guys tune in next week when we have the opportunity to sit down and talk with Robert Bouval about esoteric Egypt. So you definitely don't want to miss that episode. Hit that subscribe button so you never miss an episode or an article from your friends here at Lost Origins. And until next time, I'm your host, Andrew, and I want you to continue to question everything.